Chase. Well, I am here once again with the marvelous A.M. Holmes, who is most recently the author of May We Be Forgiven. A.M., how are you doing?
I'm very well. How are you?
Pretty well. So I want to get right down into it. You got this guy named Harry Silver. Mm-hmm. He's a Nixon Studies scholar. And this, together with a homeless version of Don DeLillo, who props up in the book, suggests a deep connection to, of course, white noise. And I wanted to ask you about this. To what extent would you say this novel serves almost as an update to white noise? And has Nixon replaced the Holocaust as the go-to reflective tragedy in American life?
Yeah, that's a very enormous and interesting question. Did you say a homeless DeLillo?
He's sort of like a homeless DeLillo. He's a ragged DeLillo in the book.
Well, he's not homeless.
Well,
he's a wandering DeLillo.
Wandering DeLillo, okay. All right.
Yeah, he's definitely not homeless. In fact, in my mind, I think, I'm stressing that because I think that the novel really sort of takes place quite near where DeLillo lives in reality.
Yes.
So I'm assured that he is well-housed. But
is DeLillo apprised of your narrative tinkering here?
I'm not
along
sure
with
about
David
that.
Remnick,
right,
along
exactly.
With all the others.
Right.
Lynn Tillman even shows up.
I think they are dimly aware, and soon will be more aware.
They certainly will be very soon. but anyway,
yes.
White noise.
To the bigger question,
Nixon Holocaust.
Right. You know, it's funny. I hadn't thought about it directly in relation to white noise, but I think sort of conceptually or philosophically, in terms of how I think as a writer. Clearly, DeLillo is a huge influence, and I think it's funny. You even see that. You know how in the, I think it is in White Noise. There's the big airborne incident,
yes.
Which, if you go back to Music for Torching, there's that thing where they close off the house with the hazmat and
yes.
All that stuff, and it definitely comes out of that. But I think for me, the thing about DeLillo that's so interesting, especially increasingly, is his ability to sort of blend fact and fiction and to combine. The exploration of fact through the use of fictional characters, like in Libra and in White Noise and in the last novel and in Underworld. So that definitely is a touchstone for me. I think the thing that's interesting about Nixon is kind of the defining American tragedy in some ways. Is
the only one people can remember.
Well, exactly, only one people can remember. But you know what caught me off guard was that this year, Ann Beatty published the book, Mrs. Nixon,
yes.
Which is a very much a sort of a literary response, not only to sort of Mrs. Nixon, but to her own kind of evolution as a writer and a thinker. And I think that book was in many ways kind of, I don't say under-reviewed or inappropriately reviewed and sort of taken too much along the lines by Nixon scholars as being about Nixon and not enough as really sort of a literary exploration. But and then also Tom Mallon wrote this book called Watergate,
yeah.
A novel. So I think it's odd that all of a sudden, without having spoken to each other, three people are sort of launching, you know, Nixon-related fiction in a given year, which I think says that, yes, there is something about Nixon that is in some ways unresolved and that is representative of sort of a kind of a classic American tragedy.
Yeah. Well, I have to ask, how much yeah. research into Nixon did you do? Because I thought immediately of David Greenberg's book, Nixon's Shadow.
I don't think I know that
you
one.
Have been, oh, it's actually, it's a really wonderful book that's all about Nixon's image.
Really?
And I developed this theory in my own head that you
yeah.
had actually read that book and said, well, I'll make the brother a television executive. but then, of course, if you look at Nixon just from a purely straight standpoint.
Right.
It was television, of course, that he learned to understand and therefore
right.
Learned to master and, of course, become
right.
who he was.
Well, it was also the television that initially sort of also undid him
exactly.
in the public eye.
Exactly.
Unless,
of course, you closed your eyes and let's do it on radio.
Well, right. So I wrote the other day this piece for one of the newspapers in England that talks about how after the Nixon-Kennedy debate, the people who heard it on radio thought that Nixon had won and the
yes.
people who'd seen it on TV thought Kennedy had won. And that was the first ever TV debate.
Yes.
But curiously, after that, Nixon refused to debate again.
Yes.
So there was no debate. Then LBJ, also intimidated by it, refused to debate. So it wasn't until Gerald Ford in 76 that the debates came back. And I think what's so interesting is we see right now in looking at actually the televised convention, you know, we all know in a way how much the media plays a role in it. But the other piece we don't even get to evaluate is how much the guy in the media truck plays a role in it. Because it's also a lot about that producer's shots of the audience or what he cuts to or how they literally frame and deliver it to us that we're not thinking about is made as choices
yeah.
that are made for us and sort of guide us in lots of ways that we don't realize. So I find that all very interesting. For me, Nixon, weirdly, is a childhood thing. I grew up just at the edge of Washington, D.C., and so Nixon was the sort of first president of my consciousness. And we took these class field trips, like to see Nixon greet like the leader of France and different things, and we'd be playing like on the White House lawn while Nixon's up there speaking, because what did we know? Nothing. Yeah. You know, we were little kids. And we always used to see the Nixon girls in the shoe department at Saks, which, funny enough, Ann Beatty writes about it, and the shoe department at Woodward and Lothrop was the opposite store from Saks in that neighborhood called Friendship Heights, just at the edge of Washington. And so it's also like things like, I was at summer camp when Nixon resigned in the South, and I remember this one counselor saying something like, I bet my mama's having a heart attack. And I remember thinking, like, that's so odd, because in Georgetown, I'm sure they're having a party.
Yeah.
So just really beginning to realize that the president wasn't just like the mayor of our town, but like this, you know, this much larger figure. So Nixon really, for me, evolved actually as part of my growing up, but also curiously, there's still more and more information about Nixon and Nixon's presidency being unveiled,
yeah,
which we don't have usually to that degree about a president.
But there's also this intriguing idea that you present in your book that I actually thought of last night in relation to the Democratic National Convention and watching Obama's speech, which
right.
was last night when we mm-hmm. when we were recording this.
Right.
You know, this is the first series of political conventions where now you're required to participate in the commentary mm-hmm. on Twitter. I was tweeting
Absolutely.
Up the storm, so was everybody else, and it's a rather fascinating idea that instead of actually studying or trusting other people to comment upon
right,
the actions,
right.
we are the ones who actually filter it. And most people are now seem to be watching like C-SPAN.
Mm-hmm.
They don't necessarily trust the news.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned this because in light of what your book has to say about
right.
Narrative, I want to get into this
mm-hmm.
too. So much, so little time, but I'll do my best. So you have at least three references to David Lynch in this book. You have the Tide cherry stems,
right.
It's a cherry stem trick.
Right.
You have blue velvet curtains.
Uh-huh.
You have a missing girl who shows up later, which is very reminiscent of Laura Palmer.
Right.
And I said to myself, well, isn't this interesting? And isn't it also interesting you even have a firm show up, Herzog, Henderson, and March, which
right.
of course is has us going back to Bellow, and of course you mentioned a little earlier.
Right.
You know, what is the degree that narrative now plays in our life if we're constantly commentating? Does fiction even have a place for reflection anymore? Or do we now have to, as you have with this
right.
book quite wonderfully, stuff our novels with commentary on all sorts of things so that people can commentate further? What of this?
You know, it's a good question, and in many ways I would say I don't actually know the answer.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, you know, the idea of does fiction have a place is an important one. And I think people really don't know anymore what the difference between fiction and nonfiction is.
Yeah.
And often they'll say, so you wrote a fictional novel? And I'm thinking, that's right, you know. or, you know, they'll say, is it all true? And you think, well, it's a novel, you know. So it's very difficult. And I'm not sure that there is a sense of what the role of the novel is kind of in culture at this point. It would be curious to actually try to think about what the evolution of that is, that
yeah.
we've kind of lost that, you know. Is it as a result of the memoir, sort of, you know, the idea that everything has to be a real thing, reality TV, the impact of, you know, all these things, have we moved away from an imagination? And my sense is that in many ways, I mean, I see this when I teach, that people have forgotten what the imagination is and how to use it. It's as though there's not any trust in the idea of being able to make something that wasn't there before, as though that's some kind of like too magical an idea, or how to use fiction and story to weave something together that is a heightened version of a unreal thing that is incredibly reflective of a real experience in some way.
Well, I can actually quote from
yeah.
This Book Will Save Your Life. You
yeah.
have, of course, the voiceover of the disaster film. What you were about to see is a work of fiction. It has not yet happened, and yet each of the elements represented are real. It
right.
was written using everything I know about the state of the world we live in, which means it's coming soon. So, here we have, and may we be forgiven, this notion of coming soon.
Right.
Each of the elements represented is real. I'm curious if this was in fact a problem when writing the book, because the first half of the book has Harry engaged in one calamity after another, and just this heap of abuse, and he carries through. But then something rather interesting happens halfway through, and that is you now have to actually sort of you know, families are formed.
Right.
Families are formed in the strangest of places. And every amount of narrative that you could actually heap upon Harry, you know, going back to this idea coming soon,
right.
You know, it's simply not enough for him to live as a character, as a human.
Right.
So, you know,
right.
I'm wondering, you know, how this dilemma afflicted you during the writing of this, and how you, this was your response, the idea of family, the idea of finding other people, and,
right.
and creating this interesting snowball effect that by
right.
the end we have all these people in the house and
right.
so forth.
Right, right. That's a good question. You know, I'm not sure exactly what the question is, but I think the thing that sort of was interesting for me is, you know, this in many ways started as a short story. Not in many ways, it did start as a short story. And so I feel like if you cause a tragic injury in the beginning, you have to raise the stakes, because uh-huh. where do you go from there? You know, on page 20, there's this gigantic upsetting incident. So part of it was that. And also the interesting thing for me as a writer was, early on, my difficulty with Harry was actually, I was writing about somebody who didn't know himself. And it's very hard to be led by a person who doesn't really know where they're going. So I think as Harry began to unfold as a person to himself, actually, he became more of a character, or a more open character to me as a writer, if that makes any sense. But
oh,
I think
definitely.
That's also then, because only by sort of coming to some understanding of who he is and what's happening to him, is he then able to make the connections? And the connections are, you know, family, and to build this family. And that's both what, not literally slows it down, but what begins to kind of ground it. And then you're not rolling from calamity to calamity. And I think it's very true of our lives as well.
Yeah.
That, you know, we often live in reaction to things, and things sort of happen to us, and it's very hard sometimes to get enough kind of, I don't know, we're going to call it traction, to slow it down, to just make choices or to take action or to, you know, not just be responding.
Yeah.
I don't know if that answers your question.
No, but it also, going back to Bellow, it totally yeah. echoes the picaresque qualities of Augie March, where he's forced to find some kind of identity, even though he goes through so many adventures.
Yeah.
He is living in response to so many developments, both locally
right.
and nationally, and even globally near the end, that it's almost inevitable you have to find your path.
Right.
I mean, you know, I guess maybe my question, my original question was, when did you know that Harry had a path when you were writing this?
I think I believed all along that we all have a path, and there must be one. and I think it's funny, that's both the adventure and the difficulty. And, you know, when you start with a character, you start with a sort of an idea, in many ways you don't know exactly what's going to happen. And I think, you know, the children, Nate and Ashley, in this to me were very interesting, because they really are like lumps at the beginning. You know, they're not very interesting. And that was a wonderful part of the discovery process, of actually watching them not just become people, but clearly they'd been people all along, but no one had actually seen them.
Yeah.
So that's that thing of them, you know, becoming more sort of present. I don't know. It's. I mean, that's the thing that's so cool about writing a novel, is as much as you're the author of it, it unfolds before you, and you literally, if you kind of think about the characters, you're just sort of activating them, and
yeah.
then they begin doing things and having relationships and surprising you. I mean, it truly is, you know, the most fun and the greatest adventure. And it's like, for me, it's like watching a movie, but it's
yeah.
like a movie that you don't really, there's no review ahead of time, you don't really know where it's going to go, and it's a slow unfold.
Yeah, but surely during the writing of this, you were
yeah.
faced with the dilemma of the introduction of various other elements, the escalation you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, is this what motivated you to set the cutoff time? Like, okay, 1 year from this Thanksgiving, that's it. I cannot explore anything more. Did you have to sort of cut yourself off at the bar of creativity here? Or?
No, not really. I mean, I think, you know, part of it was trying to sort of define a shape. And it's funny, this is the first time I've written a book. It's a very, very long book. And I finished a draft of it, and I gave it to Paul Slovak at Viking. And then he talked not about what to cut, but what to add.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, really? Because I really felt at a certain point, like, I thought, oh my God, it's getting so big, and, you know, they're going to make me get rid of things, and
yeah.
what are they going to, you know, and not be, whatever. And I was surprised by that. So there were a few things that sort of came in a little bit later that were interesting. And there were things that didn't happen that I realized, like, there was a part where I wanted Harry to really have kind of an episode of sort of a homeless person.
Yeah.
And it goes up to that edge, but it doesn't. That piece doesn't happen. And I thought, well, that's...
The park episode?
Yeah, but it was going to turn into a much more of of him actually spending some time and also potentially even having some sort of a bad end for him. And I kept thinking, why and what purpose is served by that? Because I don't think... I think in a way that sort of the tragic end or the downer end, I've had to do this big battle with sort of literature, because traditionally the books that we love, whether it's A Crime and Punishment or all the, you know, great, great books in history, they're not exactly uplifting. And I've been thinking a lot about, not that you're required to be uplifting, but it's harder. For me, it's like real work to actually think of not exactly a formal happy ending, but to get to a point where there is hope, or for a character to really push themselves past, in some way, their comfort zone to some other kind of place or some other way of experiencing their lives.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I'm making any sense in
it,
but...
Because this actually led me to... I've been wanting to ask you about the sort of vaguely surreal qualities of this book.
Right.
The whole laser tag episode.
Right. That's not surreal.
Yeah, well, but it's just real enough, yet it could also inhabit this sort of surreal quality because it's just a very unusual location. Or... the very unusual triangulation you have with the bar mitzvah in Africa.
Yes, absolutely.
Which sort of suggests that you had to remove the characters from America in order to come to terms with them. Do you require, pushing up to that limit, which you say, mm-hmm. which you didn't go past in the park, how do you, what are the questions you ask to know what that limit is?
That's a very good question. I mean, you know, I always say this, that Grace Paley, who was my teacher, talked a lot about what's true according to the character. So one of the biggest sort of rules for me as a fiction writer is not what do I think or what makes sense to me or what's my point of view. It's who are these people? I think a lot about their social and economic and cultural lives before the book has started, before the story has begun. So who were they? What brought them to this moment? And what makes sense for them. So things like the laser tag, this is a total sidebar. I had this great laser tag game. No, up at Yaddo in Saratoga, there was for a while in the little shopping mall, there was a laser tag place. And one day I took a bunch of the Yaddo fellows one night to play laser tag. And it literally was all like 15-year-old boys. And then there's all these, you know, and it was a range of Yaddo people from, you know, people in their mid-20s to maybe somebody about 75.
Yeah.
And we all went and played laser tag. And there was literally, you know, they give you these vests and they read you the rules. And they're like, there's no pushing. There's no this. There's no that.
I have played laser tag at an embarrassingly late age myself.
I secretly love laser tag. And so at one point we went in there and like some kid like pushes past me. I literally picked the kid up by his shirt. I'm like, no pushing. And I dropped him back down. So there was a Friendly's ice cream place right in that mall. And it is all surreal, but it's also entirely true. Admittedly, it wasn't a singles or non-singles swingers event that night. And they weren't all in their underpants. But they may as well have been.
But that sort of twist allows you to find a new reality that is plausible in fiction.
Yes, and you know what? The weirdest thing is, I swear if we looked into it further, it's plausible in real life, too. Yeah. I mean, I think of, like, you know, other things like Cheever's The Swimmer, which for me is a very big kind of classic thing. And Cheever in general, I think, really was a much more surrealistic writer than we notice.
Oh, absolutely. And the Blake Bailey book did a very good job of showing that.
Yes, and so I think a lot about that because I think there is a kind of surrealism to American life, and I actually think all the more at this point in time than now. I mean, our lives are slightly surrealistic, and I do on the one hand heighten that, and I always think it's like the sort of a super saturated, like a Coda color vision of the both the surrealism and the absurdity of our lives.
Yeah.
And then things like the South Africa piece. It's interesting because I was thinking a lot about the character of Nate and what would be meaningful to him. So it wasn't so much that I felt that I had to take them out of the country. I mean, it could have been potentially someplace else that Nate had been invested in.
It reminded me of Lionel Shriver so much for that, Pemba.
Yeah.
Where I thought to some degree that you might have been responding to
that.
Because you have that very real moment in the car where it's like, it's almost like, my one criticism of that particular moment in Lionel's book is that it was too driven by luxury.
Right.
Whereas when you have them in South Africa, you have this moment in the car where it's like, look, get out of your American complacency, will you?
Right. But I also love the thing that, you know, it's not giving anything away, but it, you know, sort of where Nate ultimately gives them this money, and what do they want to do with it? They want a big TV.
Yeah.
Which is that thing that, and it's interesting that that's so upsetting to Nate, because they want into this world that we have, and yet what we're saying is we're not so comfortable in the world that we have, and there are things in other worlds that are perhaps, you know, more, not just useful, but meaningful.
And yet you also include a hunger for, I'm going to try to do this without giving it away, lost communications.
Yes.
In fact, actually, there's the lost communications moment with a technological device.
Right.
In which a character is just desperately trying to find meaning through these messages.
Yes.
And then there's another moment late in the book where a letter is sent from Avery, paper product company.
Right, exactly.
And then there's a real life parallel to that that doesn't hash out nearly the same way, almost suggesting that, you know, the words contained within the medium are really, you can't really go beyond that, which is both a funny but also deeply sad for me aspect. That it's almost, you know, does it come down to individual responsibility to like, okay, you know what? This is a very uncomfortable moment, but I'm going to go ahead and do it. I'm going to live it. I'm going to find my path, as Harry does quite well in this.
Yeah.
You know, why the idea of media and narrative in relation to existence?
Why not?
Why not?
I think that we're living in that world where everything, you know, we're living in media, and we are actually making our narratives in tweets and in, you know, the fact that everyone walks down the street documenting their lives. I'm in the grocery store. I'm in the dairy section. We're constantly telling the story, but it's like as a documentation. Here's my Instagram of my dinner.
Yeah.
That's all new. You know, that's, and I don't know how that, I don't know what that means about us or where it leaves us in some ways. And does it only leave us with the surface, this documentation of like sort of, you know, IRS style, like, well, I can prove that I had the beef that night.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to when people either wrote long letters or even had long phone calls with the long cord around the house or sat down and talked to each other. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's all...
How do you think contemporary fiction can answer to this dilemma? I mean, you know, here you have a very large novel, an engaging one, I feel. But at the same time, it's absolutely more in opposite to the snapshot approach to life.
Yeah. Well, it's what a novel should be, honestly. I mean, should a novel be a snapshot?
No.
Sometimes a novel is just a novel.
Yeah.
No, I think it also, you know, I remember there was a moment, actually, you know, I don't know, about 10 years ago. And literally, Rick Moody, John Franzen, and David Wallace all wanted to write big books.
Yes.
And that was a literal goal for them. And it was both lengthwise and scope-wise. And I think that, you know, there's always this funny thing where they talk about, like, you know, the great American novel. They don't really talk about women writers in the great American novel, because we're supposed to write the great American domestic novel.
Yes.
Or whatever. And I think this, in some ways, I mean, It's one of the threads through what we're talking about a little bit, which is this is both a domestic novel and a much bigger picture novel. And I guess the big question is there still a place for it, the novel, in any which way?
Did you end up actually having to get rid of a lot of stuff after Slovak told you to add things up?
No,
oh, really?
No. I'm always like, I love to edit, I love to cut things. But we actually added some stuff. And it's because also near the end, and it's still fairly compressed in the end.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I just thought at a certain point, like, I didn't want to go past that Thanksgiving because I thought, well, where are we going? And then it's really another book. And I remember a very good writer friend said to me, I said, how do you know when a book is done? He said, because if you were to continue writing, you'd write another book.
Yeah. In terms of George, you're talking about how the surreality of this book
yes, exactly.
is not exactly surreal, that it's more real. And yet George's homicidal impulses
yes.
are not exactly, I mean, they sort of come out of nowhere.
Right.
At the same time, you are also careful to keep George out of the picture by putting him into a variety of rather unusual institutions.
Yeah.
One that is this, you know, sprawling estate that has been around for a long
right.
while. The second one in this forest where he's right. basically animalistic, and the people who actually bankroll the place
right.
are more just hooked on the logo.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, I'm wondering, you know, first of all, there seems to be almost a distrust of institutions, at least this book is arguing,
right.
that putting someone away, even in school or
right.
in the academy,
right.
You know, is inevitably not going to work.
Right.
That therapy is almost something in this book that is just really... the book, is, I think, is very hostile to therapy. I wanted to
right.
ask you about that. Was the keeping George out of the picture, you know, was this your way to kind of break down or compartmentalize this issue of finding Harry's identity and finding the American identity that's at the heart of this book? And why all the sort of, like, anti-therapy stuff, do you think?
I don't know. You know, it's funny. I don't see it that way. and I never thought of it that way. But it's I'm interested and curious about that take on it. I've been in therapy since fourth grade.
Yeah.
I'm making progress. I feel like eventually I'll understand something. No, I'm not anti-therapy. I think George has problems, and I think the choice would have been, in some ways, after the initial incident, to kind of take him out of the story altogether. Because the truth is, if something like that happens, it's not like you get to sort of stick around. You know, he really transgresses. And I'm always curious. I mean, I studied, I don't know if you know this, but I studied...
Drop the big ball.
I know, I took this class in college in prison survival. I've always been very interested in institutions and
yeah.
in the effect of the institution on the person. And by that, it's not just prisons. It's, you know, it's hospitals, it's schools, it's large organizations. And read this Irving Goffman book, Asylums, which is all about the effect of the institution on the person. And Terence DePree's The Survivor, which is all about the Holocaust and the concentration camps. So all that to say, I've always been fascinated by that.
Did you watch, like, a lot of prison films and Holocaust films and apocalyptic films growing up? I certainly did.
I have them all in my head. I don't, you know. I think in some ways, and I this would be the brutally honest version, I always had an enormous fear that I would end up either in jail or in some other place.
They'd single you out.
I don't know. I mean, my experience always was as an outsider, and I think there is some inherent sense of the institution not understanding or accepting the individual, and that the majority of individuals don't even notice that, because the majority of individuals, that's why they're the majority, are just kind of marching along.
Yeah. But that sense of anxiety that an institution will lock you away as an outsider, that's really more of an internal anxiety, I would think. That's really something where, you know, and not to mention
right.
the people who are considered outsiders at a younger age often in very strange ways become insiders. I mean, the two most notable examples I would think would be Sam Raimi and Peter Jackson, where
right.
25 years ago, if you thought they would be directing the top grossing films, they'd
right.
be like, no way.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, I think that...
Or Richard Nixon,
for that matter.
Exactly.
I mean, people,
yeah.
outsiders have a very funny way of being redeemed
right.
in a matter of years. So, I mean...
But, you know, it's interesting, because, like, people say, and I've had these, like, various times over the years, reviews have written, you know, A.M. Holmes, you know, consummate literary insider, and I think, oh, no, I'm not. Like, you know, so it's an interesting thing, too, of where the person's view of themselves is, and their
yeah.
experience of themselves, or the experience of the world around them.
So
it's a bit off track.
Well,
yeah.
no, this is actually all related. I mean, if you have to be an outsider to find truth,
yeah.
you also have to be rooted in some sense as an
right.
insider, especially if you've been, you know, writing books, you're involved with Yaddo and so forth.
Right.
I mean, I don't think it's necessarily either or proposition.
Right. Right.
How do you balance? I mean, I think you're an insider and an outsider, aren't
right.
you? Are you not?
Right.
So how do you balance that?
I'm the advocate on the inside for the outside.
So you think the insiders will come around?
I do. I don't think the insiders will come around. I mean, you know, it's interesting. I like, you know, at Penn, the Penn American Center, I chair the Writers Fund. So
yeah.
the Writers Fund gives money to writers in times of crisis or in times of something horrible happening. So there I am on the inside dealing with people who have suddenly, for one reason or another, become on the outside.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, how Obama was referred to the last three nights.
You know, I'm very involved at Yaddo, but I'm at Yaddo working with the people on the board who are not artists, but trying to preserve the fact that there is a Yaddo for the next generation. So I'm always, I mean, not always, I'm a Girl Scout leader, so it's, which to me is the most funny thing, because it's a very traditional organization.
Are you an aggressive cookie seller?
My daughter is the most aggressive cookie seller. I'm still delivering cookies from March. I think that it's funny to say, like, when I was a kid growing up, people would say, you're just trying to be different. And I literally would think, like, oh, no, I'm not. I'm trying so hard to be like the rest of you, and it does not come naturally.
Yeah.
And I think that's still in some ways the case. I mean, I think even part of all the things I do, I am trying to be part of a system and to operate within a system. But I think fundamentally, and this is just who I am, and it's interesting because I think there's probably a lot of writers and artists who are like that. I don't by nature feel that comfortable in a system.
Yeah. But aren't you overstating the idea of having to come around to other people? I mean, I think that outsiders and insiders, to a large degree, have more in common, strictly on an ideological level,
right,
than they realize.
I think that's probably true.
Yeah.
I mean, I also, you know, just to like explain a little, another level of it, I grew up in this family, so in Chevy Chase, Maryland, which is this very upper class, you know, upper middle class suburb, not upper class, upper middle class suburb. And my parents were, my father's really like a socialist.
Yeah.
So there we are, you know, and my parents are like, no, we don't eat iceberg lettuce, it's not union. No, we don't eat grapes, they're not picked by union workers. No, we don't believe in vacation. Meanwhile, all the other kids are like going to visit their grandparents in Florida and getting new cars. Oh, we don't believe in that kind of thing. So that was also, and they're always, all he ever had was these books that are like conspiracy. So just even growing up around that, I think whether you buy into it or not, and I remember always being annoyed with him, thinking like, Dad, everything is not a conspiracy. And then all of a sudden you get older and you're like, oh, well, it's maybe not everything is, but there's a lot more to most things than any of us know.
Yeah. But do you think that fiction allows you freedom to give in to that conspiratorial view? I think in this book it certainly does.
It does. I feel like I sound like a raving lunatic.
No. I mean, this is a very rational conversation, just to be clear. Maybe a little eccentric, but it is rational. Which is exactly what a lunatic will tell you.
Exactly. Well, I didn't say it. You did. But yes. Yeah.
Do you think this also accounts for some of the food in this book is extremely simple? You got Chinese food. You've got meatball pizza.
Right.
Lots of fish sticks, by the way.
I'm actually allergic to fish.
Oh, you are? Really? I mean, it almost seemed like the food here was like anti-Thanksgiving in nature.
I never thought, you know, I think that you are like the best reader. You know, you're a much more in-depth reader than the average person. But the food, I think the Chinese thing is actually interesting, because I mean, and I'm waiting for people to notice that there's obviously the Chinese food,
yeah,
the Chinese restaurant,
the diner,
that,
yes.
Harry's wife is Chinese.
Yes, exactly.
There is Nixon and
China. Yeah, and yeah. I was going to ask you about that too, because
yeah,
you run the risk there, for someone who can't remember Nixon going
right,
to China,
right,
like, wow, you know, AM's being a little stereotypical there.
Right.
So, you know, what did you do to, did you just not care that some dim-witted reader who is going to immediately accuse you of being sort of stereotypical, did you just not factor that in? Or did you introduce the character of
the transcriber?
Yes, exactly.
Ching Lan?
Yeah. Ching Lan. She's your sort of, like, guarantee.
She's a volleyball player.
Yes, yes.
I mean, she, you know, one of the difficulties is, despite the length of this novel, you can't sort of develop each character as fully as you would like to. But that said, I found her an interesting character. I found the relationship of the deli owner to Harry interesting. And, you know, weirdly enough, I had written this short story a few years ago called The Chinese Lesson.
Yeah.
Which is in many ways sort of a precursor, at least character-wise, to these people. And it was about an American man who's married to a Chinese woman, and his mother-in-law comes to live with them. And she has sort of Alzheimer's, what they think is Alzheimer's, and they have a GPS chip put in her back.
Yes.
And in that story, the woman who they think has Alzheimer's is also talking about things that are entirely real, like the Three Gorges Dam that was built that was going to flood all this ancestral homeland. And everyone thinks she's a raving lunatic. And I think in this book, you see the sort of, in part, the impact of, you know, this sort of, in a way, immigrant society on American life, on American cultural life, and also the way in which that we don't even necessarily notice how it weaves in. But I think it's really important, and it's curious. I wrote this other short story a couple years ago called Omega Point, which is curious because DeLillo, of course, has his Omega Point. And in it, it's a whole very long story, and part of it is set in North Adams, Massachusetts, which is where my grandmother is from. But it's also, weirdly, the place that, like, in, I want to say it's 1870, but I'm sure that date is not right, they brought 75 Chinese workers by train from San Francisco to bust a strike at the shoe factory. And some of those, they all lived at the factory, and some of them stayed in North Adams. And one of them became friendly with a local family and went to their vacation property in Florida. That guy, who was from a Chinese farmer family, Lu Gim Gong, developed what is the Valencia or frost-free orange that is our basic orange. So that
you've heard of the Potato King too, right?
I don't know the Potato King.
Shiba, Tony Shiba, I believe, or
really?
Joe Shiba. He was actually like one of the guys who was protesting a lot of the racism at the time, or early on with the Exclusion Act.
Right.
It's in the Kevin Starr book, which is
yeah. But so I mean, I feel like I guess I am interested in the history and in the impact of, you know, people from other countries, and particularly China, coming here. And that story also has an adopted girl in it. And the even the impact of adopted Chinese kids.
Yeah.
And what's that going to look like to them at a certain point of time.
But it's interesting that you kind of refrain from the economic relationship between the U.S. and China.
Yeah.
Was that by design? Did you feel that was going to be settled by the time the book got published? Or did you just not know when the book was going to be done?
I you know, it's funny. I think I was thinking about it more in the sort of cultural and emotional and psychological than the economic. Although the economic piece of it is fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, China owns more of the U.S. debt than anybody.
Yes.
And I also think a lot about what if Nixon hadn't gone to China?
Yeah.
And, you know, what would be better, what would be worse, or, you know, how would it be different? I mean, also you think about the amount of U.S. manufacturing that's in China.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's a very, very complex, deeply economic relationship.
Well, this, I mean, I wanted to ask you about this because, I mean, you clearly have the interest in the cultural stuff.
Yeah.
And especially with Harry, he goes right up to the edge there. But, you know, I'm wondering why the socioeconomic realities that you clearly you're interested in, why you're not really tackling them in the fiction here.
Right.
I was curious about this.
I mean, I don't have an overt reason. I think it's just in some ways a little difficult to tackle all of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing that is interesting would be to think about, and I haven't sort of gotten to this yet, you know, I have the Chinese people who are running the deli and the Chinese people who have the restaurant and stuff. What is the next step up for those families who now the next generation will be children who have gone through schools here? There's also, somebody was telling me, there's an enormous number of Chinese students who are going to boarding schools in this country from wealthy Chinese families, and because they want them educated and they want them to speak English and go to U.S. universities. So I think it's all really interesting, but it's not 100% to me at the moment obvious what or how it's going to play out. And it's funny because I really am, as a writer, interested in thinking about the economic in relation to fiction. And I feel like I sort of tried to do it, but I don't know.
Yeah.
You know.
What are the two?
I'll have to go back and rewrite it again.
Sure,
now.
Sure.
Do you think the mind? Right, exactly.
I have to ask you also about the two women in Harry's life. Cheryl.
Yes.
Who he meets through his online adventures, the laser tag moment we mentioned earlier, and Amanda, who's this person, who this young woman who just sort of stops by and is not willing to impart much of her identity.
Right.
What's interesting about both of them is that they almost have to bring Harry to their family. It's sort of like, you know, the funny thing about this book is that family is this inevitable thing you have to deal with.
Right.
Even if you go to the most perverse corners of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And
everybody has a family.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's interesting, you know, why do, for these quick flings, you know, why did that family element come about? Because a lot of people have flings that don't have any kind of concerns. Is it really empathy that distinguishes Harry from, say, any other guy getting his rocks off at that age? Or?
No, I mean, I think that he also has several other relationships that he doesn't deal with their family. So there's the one where the kids come. Yeah, there's a bunch of interesting things. Yeah. I mean, I think the fact is that people don't come from nowhere, you know? And whether or not people have a good or bad relationship with their family, people have a history, and they bring that history to whatever they're doing, even if it's online dating. They're cheating on their spouse. They're bringing all that with them. So I don't know. I guess it just, you know, interests me that way. And I think it's also, to me, I mean, it's funny to say, I don't like Amanda as a person. I secretly just, like, find her, like, oh, I hate her. But I kind of like her parents, and I think it's interesting that she just, like, leaves them with him, you know?
Why are you so hostile to Amanda?
Because I think she's not taking responsibility.
Yeah.
She's kind of vague and opaque, and she's the kind of girl I always just hated.
But Amanda has some possibility down the line. Everybody goes to that irresponsible phase at some point.
I know. Well, that's, I mean, who knows
what's in this judgmental stuff, huh?
I don't know. I don't know.
Maybe she's your character.
I know. It doesn't, you know, you don't like every character, and every character is not inherently a wonderful person. Who knows what Amanda will come, you know? Maybe she'll show up again in a short story.
Do you need to have
Amanda redeemed?
Do you need to have characters you despise to make your books honest? They just crop
up.
No.
They just, you know, they just appear in the AMP. No, but it is an interesting thing when you get one who's, I mean, she does have interesting qualities, but where you're sort of frustrated by her in the same way that he's frustrated by her, because she is kind of like unclear and just not. And you think, is she really that way? Does she not know that, or is she just really avoiding having to deal with anything or having to say anything?
So going back to the more serious threat I presented earlier about how family is inevitable.
Yes.
Do you think it's really just a matter of, in fiction or in life, spending enough time with someone, inevitably the baggage comes out, the truth comes out, the connections come out, and sooner or later you are commingling with other people and other friends and other family and so forth. That this was the idea of why, for Amanda and Cheryl, you know, family and Emily came.
You know, it's interesting. It may, yes, I think that all of what you just said makes sense. And I think there's also an element of age to it. Because I think at a certain point, you know, when you're young, you kind of go around with your friends and you're in your 20s and you've just sort of broken away from your family and you're still embarrassed by them. And you're trying basically to pretend you don't have a family. And it's sort of like you leave your friends to go back to your family. But then at a certain point when you're either in a relationship or you start having children of your own, you start mixing in other people's families.
Yes.
Or when you're dealing with your parents getting older, all of a sudden it becomes more of the core, and it really is part of the structure of our, I mean, it is the social structure.
Yes.
You know, and I think that becomes really apparent.
Or that moment where you wake up and you realize, oh my God, my friend or my family member is like that.
Right.
Which happens.
But there's also that moment too where you realize there's no point in being embarrassed by your family. Because, like, everyone's got one. You know, that you just stop being mortified by, like, oh my God, my mother is so whatever. I remember a million years ago, I was home from, like, graduate school at Iowa, and I was sick. I had gotten this horrible bug. And the phone rang, and I answered it, and it was Carol Houksmith, who was a big editor at Norton, who's, I think, since passed away. And she's like, hello, is this A.M. Holmes? I'm like, yeah, it is, whatever. And then my father picks up, and he's like, hello? And I'm like, I've got it, Dad. I got to make a call. I'm like, I'll be off in a minute, Dad. No, what are you doing? Like, you know, and I'm like thinking, Dad, I got it. Like, just hang up the phone. Yeah. And I was just so embarrassed. And he's just going on and on. And this editor's like calling.
How long
was
she on the phone?
A minute or two, but I was just beside myself in that way that only when you're really on the cusp of adulthood and you can't just be like, you know, you're not old enough to say, oh, I'm so sorry, my father is, you know, hard of hearing, or my father is a character, or, you know, whatever.
And that's really who we have to forgive, those moments in life. Okay, I know you have to go, but A.M., thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting
with you.
Hey, thank
you. And, you know, you really are just, like, the best reader of this, because I feel like the David Lynch thing, I had, like, I had notes I was in there.